On this week's 51%, mentor and public speaker Chelsea Gooden gives us some insight on the wisdom and power of teenage girls and why we as a society fear them.
This power that I have seen, it has a lot to do actually with girls are really good at saying the truth and speaking truth to power also.
Therapist Kara Crosswaite-Brindle also helps us better understand ruptured mother-daughter relationships. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. If you've ever found it hard to connect with or relate to your teen, our main guest today has some insight. Chelsea Gooden is a longtime academic tutor, public speaker, and mentor who has worked with high schoolers of all genders, but especially teenage girls. For years, she has worked with girls one-on-one, gaining their trust, confidence, and friendship through conversations on the issues important to them, including mental health, body image, social media, boys, and parents. She shares what she's learned in her new book, Underestimated: The Wisdom and Power of Teenage Girls. Gooden says society has a particular fear of teenage girls that leads it to belittle and restrict them. Just think about, for example, the jokes that some parents get when they're expecting a baby girl. Things like, oh, good luck with that. Good luck with those teenage years. As if boys, you know, are inherently easier or more reasonable. Even the little things, like the music or movies girls like, gets belittled as chick flicks or just straight up childish. Just as girls are supposed to be building independence and coming into their own, Gooden says they're often silenced and put down. And that suggests that they have a certain power that we as a society don't want to admit. After all, powerful independent teen girls ultimately grow up to become powerful independent women. In her book, Gooden hopes to better inform parents, especially moms, to help them build relationships with their daughters and empower them at this crucial age.
This power that I have seen, it has a lot to do actually with radical honesty, which is a chapter in the book. And girls are really good at saying the truth and speaking truth to power also. You know, we can look historically at examples. I mean, Malala Yousafzai is a teenage girl who's speaking truth to one of the most powerful militant organizations, and they shot her for it, a teenage girl, right? And she won the Nobel Peace Prize. So a girl has an innate ability to kind of see through things, and she still has a fearlessness herself about saying these things. What happens though is so often we, as a society, squash that voice and try to put her into this container of perfectionism and people pleasing and making sure everyone around her is happy and that she's likable. And that's when that force is what I see isn't reaching its powerful potential.
I mean, when I think of it, like, I struggle with people pleasing as an adult. So, you know, it's interesting to me to see how far back that develops.
A lot of the book is about also healing your own inner teenage girl. I find that all of these wounds really start actually in your teenage years, and that most women do carry them into adulthood. And a lot of feedback on the book is a lot of grown women being like, oh my gosh, I need to still heal that and deal with that. And that's why, you know, I like to look at the book as if we're focusing upstream, right? Like, so that we can help these issues earlier and not form these patterns that hold back women in a larger context.
So I guess, you know, like, how do you have these conversations with teens, and how do you help your daughter with things like people pleasing without accidentally passing down some of your own bad habits and bringing your own insecurities into the conversation?
Well, I will say that it is hard, you know, for parents to go into these conversations if they still have a wound and a charge around it. And so a lot of it is like, you know, if you have a hard time talking to your daughter about sex education topics and you're really uncomfortable with it, that's more, I usually ask, well, what about it makes you uncomfortable? Go deal with that first. You know I personally had to unpack a lot of that type of baggage before I felt in a really comfortable place that didn't have a charge or have fear around it. So a lot of times it does take a lot of work on our own part to really meet a girl where she's at without bringing our own baggage and agenda into the situation. Often when they are sharing big big feelings. What adults often do is we try to quickly fix it or advise or slap positivity on it, because it's hard to see a girl maybe in pain, sharing more uncomfortable feelings. And instead, what I've learned is actually holding space for those feelings, just listening. Girls do not feel like they are listened to. And then afterwards being like, yeah, that sucks. Like, that does sound frustrating or disappointing, using the exact words she used. And I always phrase everything as a question. So that's probably my number one tip, is phrase everything with a question that has genuine curiosity without a secret agenda behind it, and a non-judgmental tone. And a girl can sniff out a tone of judgment. She can sniff out an agenda, and she really wants to know that you are just meeting her where you're at, where she's at, and want to know what's going on in her world. And so often those questions that I phrase, it could be something along the lines of, instead of after she shares something difficult with me and I give my advice on how to fix it, instead I say, what do you think the solution is? And she honestly comes up with better ideas than I come up with. And then I affirm her. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what a good idea. That was smart. And then she hears that and is like, wait, you know, my idea is smart, and can own her own way forward in a lot of these struggles that she might have. Or I will ask, what are your thoughts on that? Or how did that make you feel? Or how would you like to handle this? Things that really denote respect for her thoughts on the issue.
One of the biggest things that I think we tend to inadvertently pass down to our daughters is just like certain ideas about beauty standards and body image. And that's something that they're already going to get bombarded with by society and social media anyway. So it's not like we can shield them from that exactly. But, you know, how can we help girls feel more confident in their own skin?
Yeah. So a girl's relationship to beauty and her body is so important. And, you know, eating disorders, disordered eating is very rampant. So we need to take it super seriously. And at the same time, hold space for a girl to explore her sense of identity. And it's not wrong for a girl to want to explore makeup or her outfit and fashion. And so how can we keep positivity around that while still being aware of damaging narratives, right? So I will say, I find this starts on a very simple level on how, you know, the one thing we can control is what we talk about and what we talk about in a home environment. And girls have told me over and over again that the women in their lives are constantly talking about their own beauty and their own weight in negative ways around them. And it starts, you know, that emphasis on their looks starts so young. You know, what is the first thing we say to a little girl? We're like, oh my gosh, look how cute you are. What a pretty dress you're wearing. You know, we say that innocently and with good intentions. But then when we see a little boy, we're like, what subject are you? You know, do you love in school? What's your favorite sport? What book are you reading? You know, and so we're telling girls at a very young age that their value and worth is tied to their looks. And when a mom is obsessing about her weight or dieting for years on end, a girl will talk to me about that and say how, you know, she doesn't get it. And she kind of absorbs this narrative that you're supposed to just not like your body ever. And it's really serious, because the average age that a girl starts dieting is right now 8 years old. And they also find that eight is the moment, you know, between 8 and 14 is when a girl's confidence drops by 30%. And a boy's confidence doesn't drop like that at that age. So it's something to be incredibly aware of. Again, we could just blame social media and the media. They, of course, are a huge factor. But, you know, as much as I wish I could change everything about the media, that's not in my control. Mm-hmm. And what is in control is how I speak to girls, how I compliment them. You know, there's a whole chapter on compliments and learning how to actually give a compliment that's about their unique identity and their values and how they show up in the world rather than what they look like.
I'm glad you brought up social media, actually, because, I mean, it's a big topic right now, especially when we're talking about teens' mental health. How are you seeing social media impacting girls, and how do you help them approach it?
Yeah, I like to bring something different to the conversation, because of course everyone is understandably concerned about social media, and there's actually a lot of attention being brought on that. And I like to say, you know, social media is not going anywhere. And I have been one of those people in the actual trenches of hanging out with teenage girls and knowing which accounts they follow and talking about it with them and actually helping them switch up their feed to something that feels good to them and empowering them to make the healthy choices on social media. Instead, what happens is everyone's being like, you should be scared of this. This is awful. This is destroying you. And a girl, again, absorbs that fear And she doesn't really learn how to trust herself with social media. So I really, again, like to approach it with questions like, what do you think of this post? Do you think this is like an accurate representation of beauty? Do you feel like she did Facetune on this? You know, I engage them that way. I find, you know, the girls really love following accounts that are psychology or mental health oriented. And when you get a few following a few of those, I mean, girls are sending me cool TikToks on feminism, on really cool topics that they are able to actually have good content also, but that's not an easy thing. I just like to put that out there as a potential because it's really media literacy conversations, which is just a boring way of being like, I talk about with them the TV shows they're watching and the celebrities they like, and I do it in a non-judgmental way where they feel like they can share their interests with me.
The CDC came out with a report last year where teenage girls reported their highest levels of sadness and sexual violence actually in a decade. Did that come as a surprise to you? Are those the kinds of experiences that you're hearing more of in your conversations with girls?
You know, when that stat came out, so many people were surprised, and I was not surprised at all, unfortunately, mm-hmm. because girls share with me all the time, whether it's sexual assault or sexual harassment. I'm often one of the first people they reach out to, and I've really had to educate myself on this in a big way. I even joined the board of a nonprofit called The Call to Men, which is all about ending gender-based violence by engaging men in healthy masculinity and manhood. And what I'll say is girls feel like we are blaming them for everything. We are putting all the responsibility on them. You know, girls are well aware that their clothes are going to be blamed, that, you know, they need to manage a boy's inclinations. It's all these really unfair pressures that we're putting on girls when the truth is, what's the cause of this, right? Like, it's actually a male violence issue. And where is that coming from? And, you know, just a statistic to support that is, only 11 states require that consent is taught in their sex education curriculum. Only 11. And if we're not teaching consent, that can explain a lot. Meanwhile, I know so many teenage girls who take self-defense classes in their school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're teaching them how to defend themselves, but we're not teaching boys from the beginning on what is consent, what is healthy masculinity, what is a healthy way to not sexualize and objectify girls. You know, there's so many ways we could be doing better and making sure we're not blaming and putting all the responsibility on girls.
So you mentioned earlier about the importance of meeting teens where they're at when you're talking with them, you know, like being a good listener, asking them for their thoughts on certain subjects and stuff like that. Do you have any other advice, I guess, for parents who are trying to strengthen their relationship with their daughter at this time? How can you empower your teen here instead of pushing them away?
Right. I mean, I find that building a foundation of trust at an early age really helps. It can be hard, you know, coming into environments when they're already 17 and there's already a lot of conflict. Yeah. I will say, you know, the last chapter of the book actually addresses making amends so that you can create a clean slate with your daughter. That was not something I expected to write about. It really just came from a place of the book is filled with many direct quotes from the girls. They were heavily a part of the process and the editing process. And they kept bringing up when I would ask them, what do you wish you could have from your parent? Almost everyone had said they wished that their parent would apologize to them and make amends in some type of way. It could be a big way, you know, like, oh, maybe I'm sorry we didn't handle the divorce very well. Or it could be even a smaller day-to-day owning and taking responsibility, like, oh, whoa, I wasn't right about that. Because teenage girls see through their parents. And when a parent's trying to put on a show as if they have everything handled and perfect and know everything right, a girl knows that's not true because we're all human. And so when you can clear the slate by starting a new foundation of making amends and taking responsibility, and a girl really respects that. And the front side of it, when the girl is younger, setting that foundation of trust, I really like to actually verbalize everything like, hey, you know what? I'm going to trust you to handle that. I believe you can handle that. And I'm excited to see how you handle it, you know, and just starting that type of language where she's like, oh, okay. My parent trusts me to handle this. I guess I'll handle it well, you know, like making sure that's really clear.
You do talk a lot in the book about giving opportunities to make choices and for them to even make mistakes. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? You know, like, how big of a role does that play in empowering teens?
The truth is, if you try to come in and tell a girl what to do, her walls are going to go up. She's going to shut you out. The more you can be like, okay, I'll let you handle that, the better. But also, when she's making the choice for herself, she's more likely to make it work. She wants to make it work because it's her choice, right? And that may mean you have to hold some space for something you may not think is the best choice. And if it ends up not working out for her, that's okay too. Like, we letting girls make mistakes and fail is a really healthy thing. And making sure that's a safe environment for her to make mistakes. I mean, that's a big difference I see between boys and girls. I do work with boys too. And boys are allowed to be messier. They make mistakes. They don't think it's that big a deal. They don't absorb it into their core identity. Whereas girls are terrified of messing up and making a mistake. They think it's like a blemish on their entire identity if they do. So making sure we have that resilience and that things aren't so binary, black and white, that there's this gray zone, which is the learning zone. It's where we grow. It's where we learn, and creating a lot of space for that.
Well, Chelsea, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. Lastly, I wanted to ask you about, I guess, like a frequent stereotype for teen girls. The mean girl trope, you know, that it's hard for them to have genuine friendships. Is that the case, or are we seeing more women supporting women among girls?
We are seeing a shift, which I couldn't be happier to tell the world about. I would say that Gen Z is changing the narrative around women supporting women, girls supporting girls. They are so much better at it than previous generations. You know, and in all fairness, previous generations really did only have one seat at the table, you know, one job in that company that was, you know, one seat at the boardroom table where that woman would get that one job, and women were felt like they were competing for that one job. Gen Z doesn't see it that way, and they really amp each other up. I mean, you know, people again worry about social media, but if you actually look at comments among girlfriends and social media, they are lifting each other up. They're like, "You go, girl! You're crazy. You're awesome!" You know, they do that on my Instagram, and I'll ask them about it. And they also have a lot more compassion if a girl is being mean, right? So this whole mean girls idea is just fading out in a completely different way. And I would say it's because they're, again, much smarter about psychology, mental health issues. So when a girl is being mean to them, I'll ask, you know, what do you think that girl's home life is like? What are her parents like? Do you know? And she often knows, and she'll be like, "Oh, I think her mom criticizes her a lot, or dad's never around." And I'm like, "How do you think that makes her feel?" And she's like, "Oh my gosh, that must suck for her." And I was like, "Do you think that maybe she's bullying out of her own pain?" And the girl gets it. She's like, "Oh my gosh, I bet she is. That sounds awful." Like, all of a sudden she has compassion for this mean girl. And that's what these girls of Gen Z are so much better at than I've ever seen before.
Chelsea Gooden is a tutor, mentor, public speaker, and the author of Underestimated: The Wisdom and Power of Teenage Girls. It's out now through Gallery Books. You can learn more about Chelsea's work at chelseagooden.com. Gooden mentioned that a lot of the girls she spoke with who had strained relationships with their parents were simply hoping for an apology, for an attempt to make amends. But what if that apology never comes? Our next guest is a licensed mental health therapist based in Lafayette, Colorado, who frequently works with adults navigating parent-child estrangement. In her new book, Understanding Ruptured Mother-Daughter Relationships, Kara Crosthwaite-Brindle offers advice for both mental health professionals and daughters grieving their relationships with their mothers. Brindle says 1 in 12 people have cut ties with a parent or family member for one reason or another, usually tied to abuse or trauma. While there's hope for reconciliation, especially with the help of a family therapist, Brindle has helped clients find acceptance even if it never happens. A big reason Brindle says she wanted to write this book is that a lot of the current literature on estrangement comes from the perspective of parents. And while that's important, it misses the pain of adult children who are often the ones making the difficult decision to cut ties. Brindle's work has focused heavily on daughters as they make their way through what she labels the 8 steps of estrangement.
So the first stage is usually a cycle of abuse. So this awareness that, oh, my relationship with mom was something I'm struggling with. And so after that, they can't unsee it, right? I'm like, oh, if I name this as abuse, I can't minimize it. I can't remove it from my awareness. At that point, it leads to an adult daughter questioning, what do I want to do with this information? So that's stage 2 is questioning. At that point, she might say, do I want to actually even talk to mom about this? Or do I want to let it go? More often than not, out of a place of wanting some closure and some acknowledgement and hopefully an apology, daughter moves into the third stage, which is usually a relationship rupture if mom shows up as minimizing, finger pointing, saying, this is not me, this is you. In the best case scenario, mom's like, I'm so sorry, and you deserve better, and I might be a better mom to you now, and then our cycle is done. But more often than not, with the clients I was serving, relationship rupture would be that third stage, which then leads to estrangement. So that's just the first four stages. The last four are really about like self-development. How do I heal? How do I have self-worth, right? So like we kind of move through more of the deeper work once the estrangement has happened. Sometimes that leads to reconciliation. Sometimes it doesn't. So I want people to be able to hold for both. We're not championing estrangement. We just want to normalize it.
I guess just to start, you know, I know your work is mostly from the daughter's perspective, but why is it so hard for parents to apologize or to take that step toward making amends?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a parent now. I actually wrote this book in the critical window of development for my own infant daughter at the time. But I think a lot of people, if we acknowledge that we did something wrong in parenting, then it's like, oh, I'm a bad parent, right? It's like people have a hard time separating out, I'm apologizing for my actions, my behaviors, and I am therefore a bad parent. So I think a lot of people are like, I don't want to apologize. I don't want to own this, because then that makes that true. And most of us don't want to sit in that discomfort of, what if I am a bad parent? I don't think it's usually that black and white, if I'm being honest, but I think that's the fear.
So let's get into those last four cycles, or those last four stages. You know, what does the healing process look like for daughters, or that path toward acceptance look like?
Yeah, so luckily some of our colleagues are doing the family work. So I really do feel like this is a family therapy encounter of like, how do we help them heal in the same room? Is the therapist there to stay neutral? Ideally, yes. And then they're like staying their sides and they're coming together and saying, how do we repair? How do we go towards reconciliation? It's not very often in my experience with the clients I was serving that parent wanted to come in and do the work, right? Out of this place of defensiveness, anger, minimization, they were like, no, thank you. This is your stuff, right? Which leads to some of our 10 assumptions about estrangement. One of which is, this is adult daughter's problem, not my problem. So if a parent isn't willing to do that work, we're kind of at a stalemate that it's not going to change anything. We're not going to heal as a mother-daughter or father-daughter or whoever is estranged. So that's the problem, is even though we have colleagues willing to do that work, more often than not, I was working with the individual, in this case, adult daughter. The last four stages are about working on identity, identifying self-worth without mom. There's this deeper work section, stage 7 of 8, where we have these aha moments about other relationships. Oh, my relationship with mom has influenced my intimate partner relationship, my relationship with my own children. So thinking kind of legacy trauma, if that makes sense to listeners. And so for a lot of these women, it's healing and grieving what's not going to be. For example, I've spoken before about a lot of us as women have this fantasy that mom's going to call us up one day, even when we're estranged, and say, I'm so sorry, you deserve better. I'm going to be a better mother to you now. It moves towards unconditional love, which is what we all want and need as humans. And if that's not going to happen, which is what I've been hearing from women for years, now I have to do my own work in therapy or on my own or with somebody else, professional or personal, to heal that of like, I'm mourning the loss of the mom I could have had. I'm mourning the loss of this relationship, which is also fascinating in the research because it feels like a death. It feels like a death. And for some people, that's how they respond. Like, I'm never going to talk to you again. You're out of my life. It's like you died. So for so many of these women, maybe it's a conversation of what I would say to mom if she could hear me, what she'd say to me if she was healthy and healed and willing to do this work with me. So there's a lot of therapeutic tools that make that more possible.
I'm curious, like, are there aspects to mother-daughter relationships specifically, as opposed to, you know, like father-daughter relationships or mother-son relationships that make this experience unique or more difficult?
I have found the research to say that's true, especially because we think of mother-daughter attachment, like there's no bond that's stronger than mother-daughter from infancy, in the womb even, of like there's cellular things happening, and then there's attachment hopefully happening once infant is born. And that's so different than even like male gender and mom, because the male gender, at least in American society, is like, we expect you to go leave the nest. We expect you to build a family of your own. We expect you not to be so attached to mom, because some people would say that seems odd. And others would say, like, we expect you to then attach to some other partner down the road. So for adult sons, the research is saying it's not as detrimental for them. Like, it's still painful. Please don't hear that the wrong way. But it feels like it's almost a shorter cycle for men, because they're told by society, like, we expect you to kind of move on. We expect you to, quote unquote, get over it, even though it is painful. And for women, so many of us feel like we're an extension of our mothers, that we have to make them proud. We have to reflect good things about how they raised us, that it's just more sticky to get past that or to move beyond, to separate.
Again, I know that most of your work is from the daughter's perspective, but, you know, from the parent side of things, does this grief experience look different? You know, how do they move forward?
You know, that's where I'm really grateful. There are a lot of books out there for the parent. I think there are a lot of parents who've written books for parents to be like, this is your process. This is normal for you. You know, I did try to challenge in the book, challenge, but gentle challenge of like, hey, you might feel bewildered, but there's probably a breadcrumb somewhere in here of why your adult child is saying, I don't want to talk to you, right? So having some curiosity about your own relationship with your child, asking questions of them if they're willing to tell you about it. Again, so many of the adult children I've worked with are like, I just want acknowledgement and apology. So for a parent to be like, I want to apologize, please tell me what I did. If that can be done with curiosity instead of anger or hostility, I think there's a lot of work that could be done, some great work that could be done for reconciliation. But to your question, if that's not happening, child is like, nope, we're not talking. Then I think the parent has their own grief and loss process, their own healing to do of like, this is my life now. Is my child is not a part of my life. How do I move forward? And I do reference a couple of those books in my book of like, here are some great resources for parents because that's who they were speaking to.
Well, I mean, aside from coming together to apologize or make amends, are there other things you can do to prevent estrangement or make a reconciliation more likely? You know, I have to imagine that setting boundaries is important and we talk about it a lot, but I don't think it's something that a lot of us are actually really good at doing. You know, how do we get good at setting and sticking to boundaries?
It's something that people have to work on. Most of us don't start with our family when we want to start a new boundary or try a new boundary. Family is the hardest to set boundaries with because they're the ones who are most used to how it used to be. Of like, this is the status quo. This is how it's always been. I don't want you to have a new boundary. I'm going to push back. I'm going to resist. So many people start new boundaries with strangers, people you'll never see again. Learning how to do that, practicing, building your confidence, and eventually move towards family. And I think that's where therapy is so helpful. It's this like safe container to practice that work, to have healthy boundaries with another professional, to start looking at what's my homework? Who's the person I'm going to start boundaries with today or tomorrow or next week? And then eventually it gets to family. But even just talking about boundaries of financial, physical, emotional, sexual, like breaking that all down helps people. I actually did a little ebook on boundaries and did a little quiz of like, how are your boundaries right now? Because therapists love boundaries. So it's a work in progress. I think for everyone, it is in fact a process. So there's not like a tomorrow, I'm great with my boundaries. This is something that has to be worked on for the rest of our lives.
Well, Kara, thanks so much. Do you have any other advice for those hoping to reconcile or hoping to make an attempt?
Yes, I know that feels very cliche coming from a mental health professional, like go to therapy. But it does have value, right? Doing your own work. So this could be individual work for daughter and mom. This could be family coming together when they're both ready. You know, there are other folks that have written books about like writing a letter to your adult daughter to start this conversation of like inviting them to come together because maybe we haven't talked for a while. So with reconciliation, I talk to the parents in the book about what's your agenda, asking some questions of yourself before you outreach your adult daughter or son, whoever we're talking about. So like, is your agenda that you actually truly want a healthy relationship? Is the agenda that you want to be right? Is the agenda you want to see your grandkids and that's why you want to talk to your child again? It's like getting really curious and comfortable owning, like, why do I want to talk to my daughter or son again is probably part of it. And then same for adult daughter. What is your willingness to reconcile? What are you worried about? Are you worried about being hurt again? Are you worried about going through another cycle of abuse? Which some of the people I put in the book, I have 9 women's stories throughout the book that illustrate the stages and just the heart of how this looks. And some of them did reconcile because mom showed up and did some work or mom apologized or mom's like, let's keep working on it. And then others, it was not going to happen. So I tried to show both outcomes of reconciliation and estrangement through story in the book as well.
Kara Crosthwaite-Brindle is a licensed mental health therapist based in Lafayette, Colorado. Her book on parent-child estrangement is called Understanding Ruptured Mother-Daughter Relationships. To learn more about Kara and her practice, Crosthwaite Counseling, you can go to her website. That's crosthwaitecounselingpllc.com. Kara, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks to you for tuning in to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house I could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me? They said,